fires up.
Good evening. Yes, they do. And they were told about the meeting.
Okay. Well, welcome everyone to the Arizona State Hospital Independent Oversight Committee. It is April 18th, 2024, and it is 6:04. And of the committee members, I have myself, Chuck, Alice, Melissa, Janina, Barb. Anyone else? So we've met the quorum requirements. Now, before we start, does anyone have anything to disclose, any conflict of interest? Okay. None being heard, let's call to order. Any staff updates?
Yes, I got a couple of quick updates for the committee. As you may have noticed, the new agenda format that was sent out, it's kind of aligning us more with the boards and commissions throughout the other state agencies. The agenda and public meeting notice that they're using, so we're going to fall in line with that. So it's got all the information. It's just kind of worded and broken down a little different on page two. That is, sorry, I was letting people in the meeting. So that's just a little different. And then the TRACORP Law 2000 training is going to be captured up front when new committee members join the committee. So instead of having to chase everybody down and trying to capture that and get it done, we're going to get it done up front. And it's going to be an annual training too as well. That's really going to help kind of bring everybody up to speed in regards to the conflict of interest issue that creeps up and pops up throughout the meetings. And it just brings everybody up to speed and one voice, one message. So I think it's really going to help. That's really it for me. I see Lori, you got your hand raised.
Yeah, so I took the training for this committee, and
okay.
Mike, I know that mandatory training was sent out for the governance board. So is that the same training or do I have to take it twice?
No, I think if it's the laws 200, then it's fine, Lori. All I need you to do is just shoot me over a copy of the completion certificate and we'll be good to go.
Okay.
Now they do. Melissa, you can get that certificate when you log into TRACORP and you do a search for Law 200, and it will you can print the certificate right out of the right off the TRACORP page. If you have trouble doing that, let me know. I can get it done for you.
Melissa, you have your hand up.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. And I might be staring right at it, but for the agenda, I didn't see the time.
Okay.
I may have missed it. I might be looking right at it, but I just wanted to let you know.
Okay. Thank you so much. I'll take a look at that and see if I might have missed the time on it. I might have. I'll certainly take a look at it, and for the next meeting, I'll highlight it so it's everybody will be able to see the call-in date and time and all that information.
It's there. It's there, Larry. It says April 18th at 6:00 p.m. It's on the okay. In the front, the first paragraph.
Oh, sorry. Okay. See, I knew I was. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or concerns that I can answer for everybody or anybody?
Was Kay able to finish and complete the training? I know. Yep. Tara called me, but I was in the middle of starting a webinar.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is Law 200 the training that we all were supposed to complete? Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So thanks to Tara for making that happen. I know she was having to run around and do a lot of special things to make that happen. So thank you for making an effort there, Tara.
You're welcome. Is she going to keep that password moving forward?
Yes.
Okay, so then next year, so we don't have the runaround, she'll just log on through my laptop. Okay.
Okay, great.
No problem. Just great. Give me thank everything, so Larry. No problem.
Thank you.
So, Mike, do you have any, well, if I follow the agenda, sorry. Any other IOCs on? And if so, do they want to give any updates? Okay, hearing nothing. So I know Larry last night, Access was giving updates on the Central, but my plane was late, so I wasn't able to join. Maybe anything noteworthy?
Oh, there's a ton of bills out there going through the House now. I couldn't tell you which one would really affect the state hospital. I would have to go back and through that with Frederica probably and peel those apart and look at those. And if any of them that would pertain to the hospital, I'll be certainly get that out to the committee for discussion. It looks like Frederica wants to. Yes, ma'am.
Hey, Lori, I can send the, I just got the final to send out the PowerPoint from yesterday. So if you'd like, I can send that to you and you can kind of sift through there to see if there's anything of merit for you to you know, noteworthy. I was planning to send that to all the chairs and it just came out. So I can make sure to get that out to you as well.
Okay, sounds great. And then I'll, anything that's relevant to our committee, I'll go ahead and forward to the members. Okay, review of action items, if I'm following the agenda carefully. I think last month we had a request and a motion to ask about, ask about the new admits on the forensic, because there were a lot of people to see where they were coming from. Mike did provide that report in our portal, or someone that works for Mike, and I don't know if I sent that out ahead of time, I don't recall, but basically what it shows is that we get less people for forensic GEI admissions, or GEI 75, or GEI, let's see, so guilty, except insane, or guilty, except insane 75, which I think, if I recall correctly, means it is a restored to competency. Is that it, Mike?
No, the GEI 75, Lori, is an individual who was found guilty, except insane, but the crime did not involve anybody being deaf or lasting injury to the victim.
Okay. Thank you. And what we want to see is if, since Maricopa is the largest county, one would assume that proportionally we'd have the highest percentage of people coming into the forensic, but that's not the case. It's quite a bit less. Chuck, you raised your hand?
Yeah, yes, I did. Mike, I just wanted to, since I've never heard the term GEI 75 before, I understand it sounds like somebody who's convicted of a crime that's not violent, essentially.
It's still violent, Dr. Goldstein, but it could be things like property damage. It could be something like, quote unquote, attempted kidnapping, something along those lines where the mm-hmm. where the victim was not physically injured.
And how does the state hospital differentiate in its treatment for those people rather than the GEI? Are there sentences?
It's literally a 75-day sentence where we bring them in, evaluate them, stabilize them, and then we'll send them back to the county for further deliberation to see if they want to do anything different, have the person put under court-ordered evaluation for treatment in the community at a lower level of care. But it's a pretty 2.5 month kind of turnaround to move those folks in and then back out to the origin county.
All right, do they then exit the criminal justice system at that point, or do they remain in it at the discretion of the court, or how does that work?
My understanding, Dr. Goldstein, is that they still remain in it at the discretion of the court, because we have to file a report to the courts giving a status update of the person's situation. So they may proceed through some type of other criminal proceeding, but I'm not 100% sure. We don't get very many of those. So it's kind of one-off situations, but I can absolutely follow up with everybody on the committee with more details if you'd like it on those.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries.
So if you look at just the
numbers of GEI and GEI 75 admissions just from 2019 to present, Coconino has about 5.6%. Gila County is 3.37, Graham 2.25, Maricopa 10.11, Mojave 2.25, Navajo 3.37, Pima, they win 56.18. So a lot of people from Pima. Pinal 4.49, Santa Cruz 1.12. Yavapai 5.62, Yuma 5.62. So, you know, with Maricopa having the majority of the population in Arizona, I'm only showing 10.11%. We have a disproportionate lack of people going to the state hospital from the Maricopa, which is interesting. That being said, let me go back up to my agenda. That was the previous and ongoing discussions. I don't know, and the committee can remind me if there was anything else that we were asking for. Okay, hearing nothing. Do we have any update from ASH administration?
Yeah. Hi, everybody. So this is a perfect segue into my update. I have two things to bring to the committee's attention. So the first one is that 2 weeks ago, approximately, the hospital did update its public dashboard to include demographic data for the patients on the forensic and civil hospitals. And one of those data fields is the county of origin. You can, if you want to check that out, it's on our public website, and it breaks down all the individuals who have been served by by either facility in the current state fiscal year. And then of that population, the age, race, gender, primary language, county of origin, length of stay, it's all there for your review. So correlates to what Lori was just going through with the GEI 75 placement. I do want to let everybody know that the reason that the numbers are going to be a little bit different than what Lori just mentioned as far as the county of origin with, say, Maricopa County only having, I believe Lori said 10.11%, on the dashboard, it's going to be higher than that because it's everybody who's currently on forensics right now. So that can be anybody who's been here for, you know, 15 years on our campus. It's not just that little snapshot point in time. But the data is up there. It's updated every single day. As we get new admissions, our data will refresh. As we discharge people, the data refreshes. So we're doing our best to give real-time data to the public. Everybody can have a sense of the patient demographics, the dynamics of the folks that we're treating, and the role that we play in the larger care continuum. Okay, so that's update one. The second one is that we have a couple new members of our medical staff who are going to be joining us in the next few weeks. They're currently going through the credentialing process. We were onboarding a new family nurse practitioner, and that is to make the hold on 1 second. Tara just gave a chat message. Okay, so there's Mojave pages on. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tara. Okay, so two new members of the medical staff. One of them is a family nurse practitioner who is stepping in. We had a retirement a few weeks ago, so that's a new, not a new position, but it's a backfill. And then we also have a new psychiatric nurse practitioner joining us as well. And I'm hoping that both of those individuals will be up and running and providing patient care by the end of this month, by the end of April. So that's very exciting for us.
Great. And I want to remind everyone too, we do have a new chief of quality, right? That's now on our calls.
Yep, Trevor.
Trevor Cook. Welcome, Trevor.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Okay. Anything else, Mike?
Off the top of my head, that's all I can think of right now, Lori. Thanks.
Okay. Why don't we, Melissa, would you like to do the civil forum report so you guys can hear someone else speak, and then sure. I'll go over incident and accidents after you guys give that and patient visit reports.
Yeah, so the civil forum was on April 4th. There was a pretty good turnout. I want to say around 14 or 15 patients were there, as well as obviously administration and staff, and Trevor was there too, so I got to meet you in person. As usual, you know, Tara went over old business and gave status, and then we had new business, right? And she also, you know, explained how the format is to talk about during old business is to, you know, review what the previous issue is or was, and then talk about outcomes. So the first had to do with COVID procedures. COVID procedures, because I guess they were seeing that others were like maybe wearing face masks or using sanitizer. And, you know, the patients were asking if they could also have access to face masks and sanitizer. And, you know, it was reminded obviously that the hospital takes their safety very seriously. And so they collectively look at, you know, the ability of everyone to wear masks, let's say, or use sanitizer. And there were some safety concerns with that. She also, you know, encouraged that certainly you can ask staff, the patients can ask staff, you know, for soap to be able to wash their hands. And then also just encourage everybody to, you know, keep their rooms and their spaces clean. And trying to see, you know, Tara, if she's on the phone, or Trevor, if you want to jump in and add anything, please do. The next item was the mail policy procedures. And basically, depending on the arrival, determines when you might receive it. So sometimes it's slower than other times. For example, if the mail comes on a Sunday or on a holiday, it can add an additional day because it's not screened until that one day. Right, so that does add some time. The next issue is when patients refuse medical treatment. And so there was a discussion around, you know, a patient can refuse, but if a medical doctor, you know, says that the patient needs treatment, the doctor can, I guess, administer the treatment. And so, and also work with the guardian. And so then it was also recommended that the patients, you know, speak to their treatment team and or please reach out to Tara if you know, something is hurting them, you know, so that she can help. There was a request for Nicorette gum or patches. And the suggestion was to talk with, oh, I'm going to wait. Laurie, you have your hand up?
Yes. One thing about the guardian and the treatment, I think it it's interesting because we've run across it in the past where we have a guardian that is adamant that their ward or their whatever relationship they are to the person, their ward, they want them to have X medicine or different treatment. When the clinical team disagrees and they go at loggerheads, then the guardian will think, well, we're the guardians. We have final say. But according to statute, if they're in a psychiatric hospital and they're, I don't know if it's whether they're court ordered, but the doctors and the clinical team have the final say while the patient is in the hospital. I think ideally the clinical teams, the docs like to work with the guardians, but if it comes down to a power struggle, I think then the hospital and clinical teams win.
That is mostly for court order treatment patients. And I absolutely hear what you're saying, Lori. Yeah, it can be very frustrating.
Right. So obviously, and Lori said it, I think, beautifully, that we do our best to work with the guardians and they have opinions as far as what is the best thing for their ward. But ultimately, besides, you know, doing what's best for the patient, which is our number one priority, our medical staff cannot take someone who may not have a medical background and apply what their recommendations are, because ultimately we're liable for the patient's well-being. So no matter how good serving or the guardian may be in their trying to influence the treatment for the individual, ultimately it's our liability for that patient.
Okay. I mean,
sorry, Melissa.
Oh, that's okay. The next issue had to deal with smoking, right? So there was a request for Nicorette gum or patches. And so it was recommended that the patient talk with a medical provider. There was one patient who discussed in detail the smoking protocol at, I think it was Sonora in Tucson. I didn't say it then, and I guess I'd want to make sure that this is accurate. I know at least for the projects I do, state facilities, because they're public state facilities, codes don't allow smoking. And I don't know if Sonora is potentially private. So I don't know if that would be helpful, if that's accurate to.
So I can't speak to Sonora, obviously, Melissa, mm-hmm. but yeah. So in 2006, 2007, the Arizona voters passed the Smoke-Free Arizona Act, which essentially outlawed smoking in all public places, and that includes healthcare facilities. So the state hospital is completely a non-smoking campus. We have, to put it in context, we have some staff, obviously, who do use tobacco products, and they actually need to leave campus to do so. Not just leave the buildings, but they need to physically be out on 24th Street to have a smoke break. So yeah, no, it's not allowed, permissible on the grounds whatsoever.
That just might want to be something that's further clarified if it comes up again.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I'll Dr. Flowers is on. We can verify with the social work of the social services department that's included. I'm pretty sure that's included in the admission packet that we provide the patients, but we can double check that.
Yeah. Okay. Another patient or another one of the issues was the rehab outings with the patients. And there was an update that there have been some outings to Starbucks, to Popco Park, and that there was going to be more that week. I think they mentioned movies on that day that we were having the forum. The next item had to do with hair dye and cosmetics. Oh, Lori, go ahead.
Okay. While you were explaining, I looked up Sonoran Behavioral Health in Tucson, and on the things, what to bring, what not to bring, it specifically says no alcohol, alcohol-containing liquids, drugs, tobacco, nicotine products, or other smoking materials, no e-cigarettes. So maybe when they were there, maybe they're right. Misremembering, but they don't allow smoking.
Right.
That makes sense. Thanks, Lori.
Okay.
And Melissa, I know some patients went out to go see Ghostbusters on an outing, so they like that very much.
Oh, that's great. That's good. Thanks. So yeah, the next item was hair dye and cosmetics. And, you know, there is someone, thankfully, at the hospital now. They're, you know, obviously so backed up, right? Because there's been a need for such a while that they're trying to, you know, get to everyone. But they're still, you know, they're still not able to basically dye hair. And there is definitely a request that that be able to happen. Another aside to that conversation had to do with just contraband in general. And there was a request for the patients to please ask their guardians to, you know, double check any, you know, the contraband list when sending cosmetics and other things. So there was quite a bit of a discussion around, again, the cosmetics and hair dye. That was the end of the old business, and then we got into new business.
Melissa, can I ask a question about the hair dye? Is that the patients can't have the hair dye, or the person who is now there doing haircuts, etc., can't dye people's hair?
So what was explained in the meeting is that dyeing hair takes quite, you know, it takes a lot longer than, let's say, just cutting someone's hair, right? And that there's such a backlog.
Okay.
Right. That there's just no getting into dyeing of hair right now because they're just trying to get to as many people, or the barber's trying to get to as many people as they can.
Okay. Yeah, Barbara, we've been trying for quite some time now to establish a contract or an agreement with one of the I believe one of the barber schools in Phoenix, where they would bring some students out to be able to help us out a little bit and do more like salon styles, cuts, dyes, things like that. But we've been really struggling to get that agreement in place. One of the biggest issues that we've been running up against, unfortunately, and it's not specific to the state hospital at all, but there's very stringent terms that any entity who works with the state government has to abide by. And one of them is the insurance policy to make sure, you know, if their employees do something on our property that they can be found liable for it and they have insurance to cover it. And a lot of these companies, they do not want to carry that liability insurance, unfortunately. So that's one of the biggest struggles that we're running into.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Okay, so then going on to new business, the first topic was religious beliefs. And one of the patients was concerned that they had been assigned to a group where the way that the patient explained it, you know, they were discussing worshiping of idols, and the patient didn't want to go to that group because of the discussion around idolatry, and this was against their beliefs. The patient did say that, you know, they were allowed to have Bibles, but also was concerned about a little retaliation where they were told that they can't go on an outing if they don't participate in this particular group. And, you know, it was confirmed that they have the right to religious freedom, and we had a discussion about that, and Tara was going to reach out to the rehab to rehab to talk about that.
So I was not at that forum, so I can't speak to that specifically. Mm-hmm. What I will say is that you're totally correct, Melissa. The patients can obviously opt out of any group. I'm gonna go out on a limb here and say we would never threaten a patient saying you're not going to go on an outing if you don't participate in this, you know, religious specific group. That is, I honestly hope that we would never do that, and if we did, I'd have a major problem with it. One thing that we are doing, and something that I think is going to be, I hope, beneficial to the patients and this committee, is under Trevor's leadership, what we're going to be doing moving forward is posting the questions or the comments that were made by patients in every forum, and the hospital's response to those questions on the treatment units so that the patients will know, last month you asked for this, here's the hospital's response, here's why we can or cannot do this, here's how we'll do our best to accommodate it for you. But clearly this thing that you just mentioned right now, I'm gonna have a little chat and see exactly what the deal is. Trevor?
Yeah, so some clarification on that, because Tara did follow up with the patient. The concern was more that there were outings during a group and that he felt that he couldn't go on that outing because it conflicted with his religious beliefs. And so we explained to him that there are outings throughout, you know, there are a number of outings, not just that one. And that if he chose not to attend that because it conflicted with it, he could certainly go on another one.
That makes more sense. Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Trevor.
I just want to reiterate that they do a trip planning, which is so good for the patients, and all the patients get to discuss and throw ideas out. So no, Mike, it did not happen. His religious beliefs were not trampled over. So he has the right to opt out if he feels that a movie is a little bit more secular to his Christian values. And so the rehab ladies went over and explained things to him. But they do a trip planning group on each unit, and all the patients that are eligible to go on trips, they all participate and throw out ideas of who wants to go, where we want to go, and how.
Okay, that's fantastic. Thank you.
The next new item of business had to do with groups and the request to have groups that were going to help more basically with like once they get out, right? And to make them discharge ready, more adult kind of life skills type of education and training, you know, how to use a cell phone, finances, grocery shopping, job placement, education, you know, some of those types of things. I think there was a really good discussion around that topic. How to use a credit card, all those kind of things. So hopefully there's, you know, some movement on that. I don't know if there's already.
Yeah, already I can some of jump that training. In really fast.
Yeah.
And so we did have a conversation with our rehab group. We are thrilled to share that those groups are happening now. In addition, we have COPA Behavioral Health who comes in and helps with those things as well. And so we reiterated with the patients that it's really important to attend all the groups that they're able to and that they're comfortable with. Because it's in those groups that they'll learn those things. And unfortunately, there are some patients who choose not to go.
Great, thank you. The next item had to do with food requests. There were some, you know, specific food requests, nachos, cheese, chili, you know, and some other additional food requests. And I'm not really sure what the outcome of that's going to be, but that topic was brought up. And then finally, I think the last item had to do with getting an ID. And Tara, you know, talked about helping with that and handling that through the social worker.
And we also, this came up today because we're going through the list of all the questions that you just went through or the comments you went through, Melissa. And on an annual basis, we do have MBD who comes to the hospital to do photo IDs for individuals who are on the ACPTC, which is the hospital's unit or our separate facility for sexually violent persons. And we do actually work with the MBD. If there's any individuals on civil or forensics that also need an ID, we have them done at that time as well. So we do have that availability.
Great, thank you. That's all I had, unless Trevor or Tara, if you have anything to add.
No, I think you did fantastic. Thank you, Melissa.
Okay, so Janina and Alice, do you want to report your patient visits?
Sure, yes. So we had a couple of visits. One was related to safety issues and staff shortages and so forth. I mean, the patient is safe at this time, but that continues to be looked into, so to ensure patient safety. You know, a potential transfer to another unit, if that's doable or not. But like I said, it's under, I don't want to use the word investigation, but it continues to be looked into. Then, yes, Lori?
I just had a question for Mike, since the patient brought up staffing shortages.
Sure.
How are staffing vacancies, how are you doing with filling those in?
That's a great question. That's a great question. I think we're actually doing really well. And I right now the hospital, we are staffed approximately 90% to our acuity needs, which, you know, in my mind is actually really good. I think most hospitals will be very happy with being staffed at 90%. I think that you know, Lori, you and I have had this conversation in the past. You know, there is a staffing level to meet usual and customary operations to keep the hospital functioning. But for folks to say, you know, we're short staffed, and that means that as a patient, I can't go on a pop run. Well, that's not, you know, necessary for ongoing operations. So we, in my opinion, we're doing really well with staffing. Our registry use is dropping quite significantly. About a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago, about a third of our staff on any given time or day were contracted registry staff. That number is now down less than 20%. So we're making good improvements there, bringing on more full-time employees. And the folks that we're bringing on are staying with us for a longer period of time. So I'm very happy with that. Obviously, we can make more improvements, you know, it's in a much better position than it was 14, 18, 20 months ago.
And for the people that are coming in, when you're using registry help, do you tend to get people with familiar faces, or is it a new person every day?
No, so great question. So the registry staff that we do have working for us, they tend to work a lot of shifts at the hospital. So they may, you know, they may work a full 40-hour work week at the state hospital, if not more. And whenever I see them, I always ask, why are you just not applying to come work for us? And there's language in the contract where they need to work, they need to do so many hours at the hospital. Or if they work less hours, we have to pay the vendor to onboard that person. So they typically work with us for a set amount of time. And then if they decide to join us full time, we'll interview them and hire them on. The other thing is, okay, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought, but yeah, they're essentially regulars with us.
Okay. Alice, you have your hand raised.
Yeah, that particular patient with the safety concerns, he was talking about the whole staffing issue, and I hope that he's listening, because pretty much you just covered everything that I had said to him, right down to the fact that if he's getting regular registry, most likely you guys were going to ask, hey, you want to onboard and stay? So yeah, hopefully he's listening, because I've noticed a significant improvement in staffing over the 4 years or however long I've been on oversight. So I think it's been good.
Love to hear that.
Yeah, no, that is excellent work, Mike. And it shows, you know, quite some amazing recruiting. unfortunately, staff shortages impact some other areas. So in another visit with a patient that appealed the diagnosis and the treatment plan, and was offered the psychological testing and so forth. That was completed. The patient is waiting for the results, and you know, unfortunately, like I said, shortages impact that department as well. So Mike is making tremendous efforts to look into figuring out how to resolve that that staffing issue in the psychology department. And basically that case is you know, under review, and you know, the testing will be expedited in order to come to a positive resolution. Yes, Lori.
I think for those that are newer, it's maybe worth mentioning that prior to, what was it, a year ago, year and a half time, kind of, the PSRB, the Probation Review Board, that was a board that was held at the hospital to review all forensic patients, their progress, their levels, their readiness for release to the community. It was all between the clinical teams and the PSRB. When there was legislation passed that the PSRB was to be sunsetted and it was jurisdiction was going to be given back to the Superior Court, there was some additional overhead that went with that, which I'm not sure if the hospital was anticipating. So I think that was another.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And that testing that has to be completed, it obviously, it is very, very important and very extensive. And you know, having shortages in that area puts a lot of pressure on the current staff. So hopefully, you know, things will improve, and I have all the confidence that things will improve, because you know, just during this short time I've been part of the IUC, I've seen improvements. So Mike, whatever you're doing, you're on the right track, and thank you for that. And but unfortunately, you know, we have to have some patience regarding, you know, testing completion and so forth, because we want accurate results versus, you know, expedite the results and inaccuracy.
Right. So I really appreciate that compliment, Janina, and for the rest of the members. Just for the record, everybody, we on psychology, we are not short-staffed. So we are full, fully staffed on psychology. But the problem is we don't have enough psychologists. So we could easily use 10, 12 more. We just don't have the funding or the positions to hire 10 or 12 more psychologists. That's the situation that we're in right now.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, so then I think that Lori is going to give you the answer or the solution for that. I can feel it.
My question is has that been requested to the legislature and the governor? Is that in your budget request, that I need X amount of more staffing, or I need X specialty staffing to treat maybe?
Yes. So
autism spectrum and every other.
Exactly. Thank you, Lori. So yeah, we did include all of that in the report that the hospital published last September, the clinical improvement and human resources plan that was required for us to develop and submit to the legislature and the governor's office on September 1st of last year. And I believe it said, and I know it said because I wrote it. It said that the hospital essentially needs 117 more full-time employees including, I believe, 9 or 10 more psychologists to fulfill its current statutory obligations. And that was all submitted, obviously, to the legislature, to the governor's office. The requests for those positions did not make the final budget proposal to the legislature, mainly because of the fact that the state overall has such a budget shortage right now, that just didn't make the final cut, but it has been published.
Maybe we can present the risk versus benefits of the risks mostly of having that team being overburdened and not being able to fulfill the demands or the requirements, I should say, their scope within the hospital.
Guys, when I read that report, I thought that some of that was discussed when I saw the fact that there were more psychologists needed and some things like that. Maybe I'm mistaken, but I thought that some of the reasoning as to why you guys were short in that department was stated.
I don't know exactly, Allison, what you're referring to. I know that we did discuss the change in the law that created an additional need for the psychologist to be conducting risk assessments of the forensic patients, and the additional workload that has been put on their plates given that legal change. I know we gave all the details in that report.
Then that's exactly what I'm trying to say. Yeah. I'm just not saying it right. Yeah. So Janina, that's already kind of there.
So what I'm thinking, Mike, is maybe the chief compliance officer, together with the risk management, can put together some numbers, regarding the state requirements that you have to meet, and how that department, being so small, is unable to assist you in meeting the state requirements for you for Arizona State Hospital, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So right now, Janina, we are just now beginning to compile our budget requests for the next fiscal year. And I think that's a great idea. The governor's office, the legislature, they love looking at data, at numbers. So when we present that, we can definitely, now that we have almost a year and a half worth of data, we can definitely tell them how many risk assessments, we're having to do at any given time. Each risk assessment takes about 100 hours to complete. So it's not, it's not check boxes. It's a very, very rigorous analysis of the patient's status,
right? Because
we need to make sure we need to make sure the court has all the information that they have to make the correct decision about whether or not a patient should be, progressing through levels. But I think that's a fantastic idea that we can pull that data and make sure that we provide that to the stakeholders so they know kind of where we are and where we'd like to go.
Right, right. Because, like I said, if you are required, if the Arizona State Hospital is required to meet certain standards, if you're not given the resources, how are you going to be able to meet that standard?
Absolutely.
So, real quick, Janina, did you get a copy of that annual report?
No. I would love to see it.
Yeah, I just put it in the chat for everybody to link to. It's in there.
Perfect. Because then, Janina, you'll see where there's any deficits, and then you can come up with your suggestions. That'll be perfect.
Sure, absolutely. If you don't mind emailing me, Micah, because I'm...
I'll send it to you. Okay, perfect, because Google Meet is still kind of new to me.
Nope, no worries. And Lori knows this as well as everybody. I put my absolute heart and soul into that report, so I appreciate any feedback that you provide.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have no doubt about it. So, yeah, I will be more than happy to take a look at that.
Oh, do you guys, sorry, did you want me to speak at all on any other stuff on the patient visits?
Sure. If you have anything to add, Alice, yes, please.
Well, there was a couple things, again, where one of the patients was talking about feeling like he didn't get the medical care that he needs, but it sounds like medical is being addressed with the nurse practitioner and, you know, coming on board and stuff. So hopefully some of that will go away. And again, I hope he's listening too, because that will help answer some of the issues he's having. And some other problems that were discussed were like access to their lawyer to get assistance from their lawyer to understand what resources they can use for the legal process and problems. I wasn't sure how that works as far as how they're represented and who they can speak to or find legal information.
I think that some of the patients have private lawyers, and it just depends who they pick. I mean, sometimes it happened a couple of years ago that there was a gentleman that had been, I don't think he was ever really a lawyer, and he was preying on vulnerable populations.
Oh, wow.
In the forensic hospital. And I think I sent something. Mike, I'm not sure. I don't think you were in charge at that point, but
I vaguely remember hearing about that. Yeah. I was not CEO at that point, though. No.
But I tried to tell patients when they were talking to me, you know, I had heard, because the guy actually sought me out and he called me.
Wow.
And was on the phone for about an hour or two. Chuck's like, who is that? You know, rambling. And he was taking thousands of dollars of patients' money, and he wasn't really a lawyer, and he was told to stop. I don't know what it's called when he was punished by the courts. So I think they have to be really careful. They also, if they can't afford it, they have public defenders.
I have one for Pinal County that had given me her card that I've met before, who's come to see patients where I was working. So that's why I wasn't sure. I don't know, Mike, I could probably give her a call and ask her.
I don't know, Alice. So, and this has come up, I think, maybe two or three times in prior IOC meetings. And I know Lori and I have had sidebars about this. One of the unfortunate situations that happens is obviously public defender's offices, just like every other public entity, is underfunded, under-resourced. But a lot of times what I've heard anecdotally is that, you know, the public defender works diligently while the case has been or is going through the court proceedings. But then once the person is sent to the state hospital, the public defender's office essentially thinks the case is over. So the patient at the state hospital doesn't really get the interaction or the response that they should be getting, I guess, from the public defender's office. And I don't run public defenders. I have no idea how that works exactly, but that's kind of the feedback that I've been getting, that the person's at the state hospital, the case is closed, we're not getting involved anymore. And I think with this change, with the PSRB going away and the superior courts getting involved and having the jurisdiction, I think that maybe, an opportunity of improvement that we need to make. The hospital obviously cannot do anything to defend the individuals or the patients legally. We are now a plaintiff to the case, but I think there is a disconnect there that I'm not sure exactly how to bridge.
Yeah, the disconnect for him, I think, was understanding the legal process related to his case a little better. And he also wanted to understand more about how he moves through the different levels in the system. But PSRB addresses that with the patients, right?
Well, no, PSRB is defunct. It's gone.
Is gone.
It was sunsetted on December 31st of 2022.
And I've been on for 4 years. I'm embarrassed.
About a year and a half now. But at the end of the specific questions, and Alice, I apologize. Is this a forensic case or a civil?
I believe forensic, right, Janina? Forensic.
So, you know, social work can work with that individual as far as the level progression criteria, and then we can do whatever we need to do to give that person what they need to know.
So, is there a liaison or with the public defender department? And I'm sorry for my ignorance. I'm calling it public defender department. Because I don't think that the hospital should get involved with any legal issues except what is within the hospital scope. So
I don't know if I would use the word liaison, Janina. The hospital is represented by the state's attorney general's office that speaks for us on any kind of court hearing. But basically, I'll just give like the quick kind of 20-30 second overview of how this works. So for forensics, we have an internal committee called Special Class Committee or SCC, where we internally review how our patients are doing and determine whether or not the patient can be recommended for progression to a higher level of less restrictive or more options to them.
Right.
When we make that recommendation, if the option is for conditional release to either the hospital, meaning the person would go to the community reintegration unit on our campus, or to the community, the superior court has to weigh in.
Got it.
So we submit the reports. If we decide, yes, this individual is, you know, treatment compliant, medication compliant, we think the risk is low, they can proceed, we will notify that patient's lawyer of our decision, give that individual, the lawyer, our report, and say, if you want to proceed, go ahead and file it with the court. And the lawyer needs to take that next action and file with the superior court to begin the process to have the case reviewed and the patient move forward.
Okay. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, anything else, Alice or Janina?
Okay, sorry.
Nothing from me. Alice, go ahead.
I would just say again, just some of the consistency that, like I said, that we were hearing was related to medical issues. So hopefully some of these patients can be reassured that you guys have the new staff coming on. I don't know how, do you alert the units at all about that kind of thing? Because I know it's something that would probably give them a lot of relief to know that there are new medical practitioners coming.
I don't think, Alice, we make a formal announcement, but word of mouth travels incredibly fast. As I'm sure you can guess, but the individuals, once the onboarding process has been completed, they'll do a formal handoff, and the patients will be informed that they have a new primary care provider or a new psychiatric provider.
Okay, well, that's great. Perfect. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, so some other things. We're moving on to overview of incident and accidents. I put myself, but I didn't see any notes from any patient visits. I'm trying to remember, you know, time kind of blurs of the last time. We did have, I think we did have a patient call, and the patient was concerned because they were concerned with preventing a preventing not having proper medication following the procedure that the person was used to enduring, because they've had a condition over many years that requires a medical procedure, which is known to be painful. And they were getting initial feedback from their primary provider that there may be an issue with medication that was needed. When we had the call, it seemed urgent because the procedure was the next day. So I think I called Mike, and I think Mike, you and Dr. Flowers went to look into that. And I haven't followed up with you, but hopefully that didn't happen again.
Thanks, Lori. Yeah, Dr. Flowers and I did touch base on this, and I believe Dr. Flowers, jump in if you're able. The direction that we gave was whatever the prescribing doctor at the medical facility dictated is necessary, that our providers need to follow suit.
Correct. We had made it very clear to the physical health providers that whatever procedure was done and the provider who did that, whatever their recommendation was in terms of pain management, should be carried through back to the hospital. And I think that message has gotten out repeatedly to the medical providers.
It's actually kind of, and I don't want to downplay this at all, Lori or committee members, but this is something, and I think maybe Janina can even chime in on this one a little bit. You know, we always have discussions about care continuity, right? The importance of it and how critical it is to make sure that the patients are safe as they kind of transition through various levels of care. We weren't into that situation ourselves at the hospital when we discharge a patient who we've had for, you know, numerous years and have stabilized on medications. When we discharge them, the outpatient providers change their medications, and then they become surprised when the person decompensates. It's like, what do you expect? That's going to happen. We had them stable, and then you decided to change their medication regimen. It's an ongoing battle, unfortunately.
That is very unfortunately. Yes, you are absolutely right.
Yeah.
So hopefully that can be prevented.
I think that what you can do, if you've been down that path before, what we did when our son was finally stabilized at Arizona State Hospital and was there for a year and a half, he was really stable and really good. And what we put in the discharge plan with the outpatient team, that they could not change meds. I said, as guardians, this is what we're saying. And they kept him on the meds. I mean, they don't always want to, because it's more med management.
But Lori, that should not be the case, because, you know, I mean, what is the rationale to start changing the medication regimen that got them stable in the first place? Unless there's a severe adverse reaction or something that is very concerning.
Chuck can tell you, we've been down this road so often, not since our son stabilized at Ash.
Yeah, no, I believe you, and I've seen it, and I do not condone that practice at all, because it's, why mess with something that works, right?
Okay, so this is very, very simple to understand, actually, Jimmy.
Right.
And in most cases, it goes something like this. Everybody knows that long-acting injectables is a superior way to deliver antipsychotic medicine.
Absolutely, 100%.
For quite a few patients.
Yes.
So if you're in an institution, like, for example, Arizona State Hospital, and they have you on a long-acting injectable, and you're then discharged. Well, whoever your new provider is going to want to switch that patient to the much, much, much cheaper oral form of that antipsychotic medication. And that happens all the time. As a matter of fact, Access is now going through a particular perturbation of their policy, which I hope everybody is aware of and will do whatever they can to nullify. And that is to say that you have to fail at a good number, anywhere between 4 and 6 different medications before the psychiatrist that you're taking care of gets to put you on the particular medication that he wants to. In other words, they're trying to save money. This is something that's fairly new, came about as I understand it, and I don't understand too much, but it came about as a policy change in the pharmaceutical part of Access during last summer. And I'm particularly upset about this, and you all should be too, because there is no better way to get rid of somebody's progress than to take them off a long-acting injectable and put them back on oral medication.
I agree with you 100%. And, you know, just let me know what I can do to fight that, because I will. I'm a huge believer in long-acting injections. You know, there's steady state in the system. You know, Dr. Flowers, help me out. I'm blanking out. It's basically helping the brain regenerate and so forth. It's a preventative approach to a severe episode of decompensation.
Everything you're saying is true, but really what this comes down is compliance by the patient, okay? And as we know, many patients want to drop off their medication or hide it or cheek it or spit it out or throw it up. And that's the major advantage, in my mind anyway, my own opinion, of long-acting injectables. Not that they're inherently better, because actually they're just usually oil-based suspensions.
It's definitely all about the compliance, because I would say 25% of the crisis patients that I've taken care of over the past several years, because I go to all of the facilities for where I was working in 3 counties. Anyway, I would say about 25%, it was because their LAIs started getting denied, and a lot of them are on the street, and they would say they don't have access to get their pills. And I have fought with Access to get them their LAIs. It's very hard.
Well, I agree. I agree. And sometimes you have to throw keywords as like negative outcome, liability, etc.
Yes.
I fight that because it's the right thing to do for the patient. So if the insurance is denying the medication, then they are going to assume liability for whatever happens to the patient.
That would be a really good thing to bring up maybe with the legislature, because it costs the state a lot more to continue to have patients going in and out of the system. And so that's where I would come in and say, hey, if this patient doesn't get their LAI, they're going to be here for another 2, 3, however long weeks. So do you want to pay for that, or you want to, dole out the $1,000?
Correct. Because
I'll send you guys the link to where you can put your public comments.
Please do, because if you think about it, 1 or 2 days of inpatient treatment is equal to a long-acting injection. So if the patient stays in the hospital for, I don't know, a month, 2 months, whatever, how many long-acting injections can that cover?
Yes. Well, I just want to say one more thing on this, because it's just inherently obvious that this is a systemic failure. And the reason that this is a systemic failure is that patient decisions, instead of being taken care of by medical people, are being taken care of by bureaucrats who have a very short-sighted view of the future, which is basically maintaining themselves in the positions that they are. And they are not looking, unfortunately, Alice, at the long-term gain to the system. They're looking at the short-term benefit to themselves.
Sorry, I didn't mean to have my hand up. Exactly. And that was basically the argument that I would make with Access. When I would call, the nurse practitioner would call, I would just go on ahead and make the phone calls too, because the patient, like I said, would be sitting there and getting worse.
And Dr. Goldman, you're absolutely right. And one way I've learned to get around that is numbers and, you know, standard of care. And if there's data in how long-acting injections prevent hospitalizations.
I have a paper on it.
Hmm?
Yeah. I have a paper on it, so I can send you. I did a blog about it years ago.
Okay.
But one thing, I think it's not just long-acting injectables. The other thing I see is that, especially if you have someone with a disorder that's more complex or requiring more medications that have to be taken more than once a day, oral meds and long-acting injectable, which is not it's not unusual, especially if it's schizoaffective or something like that. The antipsychotic isn't going to do it by itself. A lot of times, the outpatient providers, even the ACT teams, do not want to do med ops once or twice a day. So they'll right away try to drop the oral meds to reduce the amount of med ops that they have to do. And if you get on clozapine with all the other meds that are required, it's just more, you know, more med ops and more issues and more people that don't want that to happen.
So obviously that requires some education regarding liability that the provider is putting themselves, you know, under if they do things like that. So I hear exactly what you're saying, Lori. And I'm not perfect as a provider, okay? I'm just saying.
Yes, you are. You're fine.
No, I'm not. I'm just doing the best I can. Yeah. I call myself a helicopter provider, you know? But anyways, so whatever I can do to help, please let me know.
So I just, before we cancel, we move on to the next topic. I think everything that we're saying right now is incredibly important to the overall structure of how patients move throughout the system of care. I mean, and cost is obviously, unfortunately, one of the primary drivers of what we're trying to accomplish to make our patients' lives better and help them reintegrate into society. You know, we have at the state hospital, we have patients right now where the state is paying $5,000-$7,000 per month per patient on their medication. So for us to expect that when that person discharges to an outpatient facility, that outpatient provider is going to want to pick up that tab and continue that medication regimen, let's not fool ourselves. I mean, they are for-profit entities who are trying to contain their own costs, just like every other facility in the state of Arizona. So we need to do a better job in this.
Well, then they need to get a degree in business and do that versus, you know, do harm to patients in the name of the costs.
100% agree.
Okay. So the next thing I was going to talk about was, I went over decision letters. So these are letters when someone files a grievance. And of the letters that were issued this month, two were not substantiated, which meant that the grievance or complaint that the patient filed was not substantiated by the investigators. One was substantiated and resolved, so that they had come to a agreement and things worked out. And there were 19 that were dropped, which or withdrawn, which means that patient filed them, and when the investigator went to talk to them, they said, okay, I don't want to pursue this anymore. Some of the kinds of letters would be like, I'm not getting X and I deserve X, or I can't use the phone during this period of time, or someone stole my headphones. And what happens is they find they're in the nurse's station, things like this. So that's some of the letters I was reading, why the high number of withdrawn. Also, not all of them, but some of them seem to me to be time related. A couple of them I saw, the grievance happened in February and it was resolved, you know, in this time frame. So it could be that at the time the patient filed it, they're really upset, but by the time the investigation goes on, they've calmed down and that's no longer a fight they want to have, or they've resolved the issue. Any questions on those? Okay, the next thing I wanted to talk about, and I'm turning my camera off, so I'm looking at my big monitor so I can look at some of the reports. One thing that I always look at is the assault perpetrators. And typically, most of the assaults on either staff or other patients are committed by a few people. What I'm noticing now, Mike and Dr. Flowers and Trevor, is that we have one patient that's just a very high incidence of assaults. 14, I don't know why I can't see if it's on staff or on, I think it's on other patients. They had 14 incidents this month on other patients and 5 on staff. That's one person with 19 assaults. And then the next one committing the most was only 2 assaults. I'm saying relative only, 2 assaults on patients and 2 on staff. And then from there down, you go down to the 2 and 1. So that's a big improvement in what we used to see. And I know that there were some discharges of some patients that tended to have difficult behaviors and they really didn't belong in ASH any longer because their primary problems were not psychiatric any longer.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't know the, I can't think off the top of my head. I think I have a sense of the individual you're referring to, who is the higher assaultive individual, Lori. And I think Dr. Flowers and I have had discussions about this individual. This is another one of those folks who we have concerns about potential issues with dementia that we are pursuing Altex evaluations on. And hopefully, obviously we're not a dementia facility or a memory care facility, that this individual most likely should be transferred to a skilled nursing facility with folks who have the expertise and the qualifications and the certifications to address their physiological needs beyond what we are capable or able to provide.
Thank you. Okay, so let's go on to a few of the incident and accidents I pulled out. As you guys know, anyone on the committee that would like to review the incident and accident reports, they're usually put on the portal 1 to 2 weeks before the meeting, and then you can review it. Of course, make sure you keep the information confidential. I pulled out a few, and I'll start with some of those and reasons why I pulled them out. So first one is ASH 2020 24-0830, and it involved injuries to patient, staff, or visitors, patient threatening staff, and then seclusion or restraint. And the patient wanted to call parents, and parents didn't answer, which initiated the patient becoming angry and starting to decompensate. And in the midst of this, then they started charging towards staff, swinging and attempting to hit the staff. It said no contact was made. Patient was placed in a physical hold, transferred to the restraint chair. But down in the nursing note, video was reviewed, no quality of care. Down in the nursing notes, they listed all the BHT staff involved in the code. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, RN and several, 5 BHTs. And even though it said above, there was no contact made, it said below this, this one BHT, minor injury sustained, security added pictures with pics to be added. And then there were no recommendations, but they offered employee assistance program line to the patient. So when I read this, I'm assuming, and this is an assumption that may need clarity, that even though the patient that was decompensating and then charging towards staff missed, that maybe during putting the patient in the physical hold or the transfer to the restraint chair or the transfer to seclusion, that's when the injury happened?
Yeah, Lori, that's you're totally correct. We do utilize across the facility, we have mechanical restraint chairs. And at the time, when we're trying to put patients into that chair to ensure their safety and the safety of our employees, things can happen. So the patient may not have directly struck one of our employees, but there may have been like an adverse contact during the restraint episode that resulted in the issue that you're presenting.
Okay. That's what I figured. The next one is ASH 2024-0834. And this is unusual. You don't see many over the course of a year or two, but there was an AWOL attempt by a patient. And it was late afternoon. A patient was witnessed climbing a fence and almost made it to the top per the registry nurse, registry behavioral tech. They were verbally redirected and they responded and climbed down, but then they started charging towards the staff. Staff called code gray, patient was put in hold, brought to the seclusion room. They did a search of contraband, no contraband found. They did accept the medication. The patient just said, I just wanted to escape. And the patient has no insight but denies thoughts of hurting themselves or others.
So on this one, Lori, I just want to make it clear to you and the committee that as far as climbing the fence, the individual made it up maybe 6 feet approximately up our chain link fence. Anything above maybe 8 feet is quote unquote no climb, and the fence is 12, 13 feet high. So he really didn't have any kind of chance of escape. He would have been able to get up maybe, you know, 10 to 12 inches higher, and then his fingers would not have been able to have a footing to be able to get any kind of grip. So it's really, this IR is not written maybe as effectively or accurately as possible. And Trevor's working with the team to be more accurate in their IR writing, but there was no possible avenue of an AWOL or an escape at this point.
So I've been on the campus, and this one was not on the forensic side, I'll just say that. So, and I have never been out on the patios of the civil. I've been on patios of forensic. And the civil campus was the patient. So I don't know, was this in a unit in the patio, or was this in the mall? Because I can't imagine, because I've been there, so I can't see where they would be climbing.
This was the unit patio.
Okay, I've never seen those.
And even, and just for the committee's understanding, even, you know, moonshot, if this individual was for some situation able to get over the fence line, they're still within our secured perimeter, because we have a secondary concrete block wall with razor wire that they would not be able to get over without severely injuring themselves before our staff were able to intervene. So I'm not concerned about this situation, you know, at all.
Do you guys use technology such as cameras that would notify pagers that someone is in this red zone and they shouldn't be there?
On civil, no, Lori. The forensic hospital and the ACPTC, our sexual offenders unit, does have sensors that will alert if an individual is in an area where they should not be. There are microwave sensors, or if the fence is touched, it'll send off alerts that somebody may be trying to get out of our secured perimeter. But on civil, no, because civil has the secondary block wall behind it, and the patients on civil are always under some level of heightened observation by our staff.
Okay. And the last one,
there are cameras out there, Lori. They just don't like send out like alerts. Exactly. Right.
Okay. So here's another one, Ash 2024-0908. And this one was that a patient wanted additional snacks, and the patient, I think, because remember, for me, that it's blacked out, so it's harder to understand. But I think the patient received some snacks, and then they wanted more snacks, but they didn't take any or get any. I'm not sure. I guess they must have gotten the snacks, and they went to eat the snacks.
Oh, shit.
And someone came over, and then someone started to hit the patient, and it happened very quickly, and someone was bleeding and someone had blood on them. So it wasn't very descriptive, but what I noted that Terrence Skaggs, the quality management team, initiated an event review at the request of ERMT to review the process involved during the incident. I'm not sure who ERMT is.
Oh, sorry, Lori. ERMT, that's the acronym for the Executive Risk Management Team. That includes myself and essentially the entire EMT, or the executive team. We meet every single day to look over all of the reports that have been submitted in the past 24 hours or past business day since we met last. And that team will initiate event reviews, quality of care, QOCs, when we see an IR come through that we have concerns about, you know, what happened here, we need more information, can we do a follow-up, things like that. So that's essentially the executive team, which includes myself, Dr. Flowers, Trevor, all of our the C-suite, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any questions from the team on any of the reports, or any questions? Okay. Is there any other business or any discussions that you'd like to talk about before we go to public comment, and then after public comment, we'll go to executive session to discuss a new member who's been patiently on the whole time, Jan Jepson, and we'd be very excited to have her as part of our team. But we will go to executive session and discuss, and then we'll end executive session and we'll come back to the public meeting to do the vote and then adjourn. So that's just kind of the run of show, high level. So anything that you'd like to talk about that I may have skipped over, forgotten, or any information that you'd like to request based on any of the discussion tonight?
I just need to get asked to make sure that I can locate that portal to review those incidents and so forth.
So, so Trevor, does Janina have to do anything different, or do we just have to give, you have her email address. Do you just have to add her to the shared drive?
Oh yeah, we can totally do that. I didn't, that's actually a great point, Lori. And I believe you may have more new members than just Janina. So as folks join the IOC, just send either Trevor or I their email address. We'll get them added and they could be, they can access the information.
Okay. I'll send you a quick note with everyone's email.
Perfect.
Okay. So anything else before we go to the public? And remember, just so everyone knows the rules of public meetings, during public comment, the administration nor any of the committee members can respond if a person is expressing an opinion or asking a question. We're not being rude. You just cannot talk and have a dialogue during public discussion. Is that correct, Larry? Larry should still be here.
That is correct.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
You're good.
Okay. So if no one else has anything to say, what we'll try to do, since we're going to have public executive committee and come back to the main meeting, before you leave, before we stop this meeting, Larry, do you want to put it in the chat, executive session link for the members, or have you sent an email, or do you want to do both?
I could do both, but I'll certainly put it in the chat right now.
Okay. So for all of you that are committee members, you may want to grab that URL, because we're going to, at the end of public comment, we'll leave this meeting. And then we will join the executive session meeting. We'll have our discussion, and then we'll come back to the public meeting, the original URL, to vote. So I'll be looking at the chat to make sure we get the meeting. With that, let's try to keep our public comments to 3 minutes each, and I'll put a little timer on. So do we have anyone from the public that would like to speak? And if so, let us know. You don't have to give us your name. You can remain anonymous if you'd like, or you can state your name. And again, this isn't about your private treatment, but you can talk about general issues. Do we have anyone from the units on?
Hi, this is Timber Briscoe from Mojave. How you doing? I can't respond, but you guys were talking about guardians were trying to advise how they would like better care for their ward. The patient knows their body way better than anyone else. Some patients have been dealing with these issues for multiple years, even decades. When Ax sends me to the doctor on the streets, the one that they choose, they quite a bit of the time still don't follow the recommendations that were given. and fail to. We're not rookies at this. Like I said, we've been doing this for many years. And the doctors here tried to tell you something that isn't true about the treatment plan. Like, let's say I've heard this before. I don't want to give you another MRI because that will give you too much radiation exposure. There is, if any tiny amount of radiation, MRI is not done with radiation. The groups that they have here are very pointless, like movie music studio, open art, guitar skills, Spanish talks, book club, game club, games group, running cardio group. What are those going to do to help me become a independent, productive member of society and to succeed when I get out? And there are no types of life skills taught here. Let's see. And the COPA is only for Maricopa County patients only. If you're not from Maricopa County, you can't be in COPA. We had 9 searches in 30 days. This is very stressful and on quite a few of us due to PTSD that have been diagnosed with PTSD also, with COs or DOs or police department, these type of people, and they're tearing apart our room and very disrespectively, throwing our clothes on the floor, stepping on them, dumping things out, going through each and every one of my photos, viewing my entire life from the outs, very rudely. Obituary fell on the floor face down, got stepped on. It was very hot. The budget that Ash talks about, they can't afford to buy us larger folks. There's about 4 or 5 of us extra large men on Mojave, and they can't buy us these shirts that are like a spandex or polyester so they breathe so we don't sweat so bad. They can't afford to buy us any because they're broke, they said. So this is also cutting into what type of food. They went to a different vendor, the amount of food, and Ash is just becoming more of a prison type environment. We can't do this, we can't have that. All of a sudden, can't have very much outside time due to not enough staff. Keep taking more and more things away and not replacing any of them with anything. Like I said, the group skill, the life skills and groups that we need, they're taught in prison. HVAC, cooking, budgeting, how to do business, all that's taught in prison. We would like a notary that doesn't charge us. Here at the hospital, one of you guys could become a notary. We should have one because the one that we have access to charges $50 a page, and we don't have money like that. We would like access to information, like a phone book or 1411, to get addresses and phone numbers of lawyers, businesses, companies, organizations, stuff like that. Let us help ourselves with some basic accommodations like that. Civil patient is still on my side, which is the forensic side, tethered hands and feet and confined to a seclusion room for more than 9 years. That's what they did with Mr. Contreras. They stuck him in seclusion. They let this man out every day if he chooses to. But a seclusion room is not supposed to be a bedroom. Quote Aaron Bowen a few years ago said that forensic and civil patients are never to be housed together. This is a civil patient. He talked about medical care. Then why haven't I had anything done with my private area? It's been 5 years as of February.
Hey, Tim, okay, I have to cut it off. It's been about 5-6 minutes. But thanks, Tim.
Here,
we have anyone else?
Please, eight and down. There's nobody else there. That's why I kept going.
Yeah, this is Robert Dunn on Mojave. Let's see. For this man here, he finally gets to see a urologist every surgery on May 1st.
About surgery.
For the profit industry, I recall about the tablets and how the vendor stated we wanted to make enough money, and that's why we don't and can't help Ash. You are for profit here, I feel it sounds like. Tech board DE refuses to do anything for me or any other person on this unit. Logs into laptops for visits and then sometimes logs into his personal email to set the visit up because he can't figure out how to set up the visit with the hospital's emails. Also, sometimes he plays on his phone on the floor or inside the bubble for hours, sits on the computer for hours and won't let us out to do anything when requested. Let's see. I've asked for entire grievances and complaints and IR reports and to be unredacted, and that they always come redacted. I've been trying to work with the patient advocate to get phone numbers and addresses, and which ones I get, they're not exactly what I'm looking for or asking for. Snacks. We are told that we cannot keep no snacks in the fridge after snack time, but for diabetics and for people that take meds at nighttime, our snacks are given away, so then we have nothing to take in the middle of the night with our meds. If my friend here, if his blood sugar drops below, and it did just the other day, to 67, which is the lowest that he's ever been that I know of, the hospital pretty much did nothing to help him out. Other patients had to help him with snacks and juice and dinner time to bring that blood sugar back up. Let's see. We would also love to call and let staff know they're calling at a certain date time prior to meeting to talk to you guys. They never tell us, and when they do, it's always 5 to 30 minutes after you call, which, you know, doesn't help us in any way get a hold of you because we're not given your phone number or any way to contact you by email or anything else. I was told by Tara yesterday that the information that I did request and get from her, you have to do it online. We, however, do not have the ability to get online to send requests and file grievances without an email address and some place for that to be sent back to, which requires an email address. So hopefully something will come of this. I know that I'm unable to go to the patient forum this coming next month. I'll probably be ROU because of my plan that's been set up with the administration and the treatment team. I've told my treatment team that this plan is not helping me out. It is actually making me regress. So thank you for taking the time to listen to me, and have a great evening and a great day.
Thank you, Robert. Do we have anyone else from the public that would like to make a public comment?
This is Tim. One last thing. I asked for my entire complete grievance and complaint IR report list back in early June of 23. And patient advocate just came to have me sign a release for them about 2 weeks ago. June of 23, that's 2 months away from being a year. Thank you very much, and we would like you to call Mojave and speak to Mr. Bernstein, Mr. Babrisco, and Mr. Dunn. please call a day ahead time at least and let them know you are calling at a certain time or day so then we can be ready, because they don't give us any heads up. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Do we have anyone else we haven't heard from?
Yeah, this is Mr. Charles Edmark on Trinity Unit. I'm also with, I'm on Trinity Unit, and I'm the creative executive director with Van Bronze and Van Bronze. We'd like to thank you all for the mirrors that were put in the weight room. We need one more wardrobe mirror in the aerobic room. We appreciate your considering this. Also, have a happy spring, everyone. Secondly, our new chaplain, Mr. Green, is not working as much time as our excellent first chaplain, Harris. We would like, I invited Lindsay Arendt to be here today on the phone. I also spoke to Chaplain Harris. We'd like your input on this. We're trying to verify if he's getting paid the same as Chaplain Harris. Okay. And the next issue is a real gymnasium. We cannot play basketball in this small recreation center. We can't play volleyball. We can't play ultimate frisbee. We don't have a stage for performances and presentations. Yes, we're requesting that this legitimate real gymnasium be due south of Building 8 and Building 9. Approximately 2/5 of an acre is available. Anybody like to help us on this? You're welcome. One of my numbers is 928-351-7679, Mr. Charles Edmark, or 970-305-5055. That's our Rocky Mountain number. Please leave voicemail on both of those. And oh, we're also working on a 4th of July dance. Please feel free to contact me and others about this. We haven't had a dance in what, 3 years or so? Great, it's great for morale. Thank you so much. Have an excellent evening.
Thank you. Do we have anyone else we haven't heard from? Kay, are you on tonight? You've been very quiet. I'm not sure if he was on or not.
This is Tim. The podiatrist has quit. The male podiatrist has quit, we've heard. I have been canceled 7 times in a row. So I don't know what they can do, but please get somebody to take care of our feet. I'm diabetic. I have ingrown toenails, and I would hate to lose a foot because of this. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay, without hearing that, does everyone on the committee have the link or the phone number for the executive session?
I do.
Does anyone need me to read out the phone number? Okay, so let's adjourn. Do I hear a motion to adjourn to the executive session for consideration of the new board meeting?
Move to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
I'll see you in another meeting.
Okay. The link is open. It's ready.
Thank you.
It's just me. It's just me and you.
Okay, so I was looking back for James.
We just had an executive meeting. Now we're back in our public forum, and we'd like to have a vote to accept Jane Jepson on the IOC committee. So do I have a motion?
I motion that we accept Jane Jepson for the IOC.
I second the motion.
I second.
Okay, Alice seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay, so unanimously, we've accepted Jane. With that being said, do I have a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
I second.
Thanks, guys. That was a good meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Good night, everybody. Take care.
Thank you.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.